Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Stop shuffling through life like a zombie. You're bumming everybody out. Grab a CardoMax Energy Intensifier and wake up. Owned and operated by former Navy SEAL Sean Mattson, CardoMax's Energy Intensifier will help you power through your workouts and dead afternoons with vitamins B3, B6, B12, caffeine, and BCAAs. Use the promo code DB to get 30% off your next four orders at CardoMax.com. That's CardoMax.com, helping you achieve your max. Welcome to Drinking Bros Podcast, kids. We got a very, very special guest today, D'Anthony. I don't say very, very, very often, but I am today. We've got General Stanley McChrystal on the show today.
Yeah.
Somebody super important, you know?
For sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely
yeah.
Important.
Usually important, some of our guests aren't.
Important part of American history. Well, sometimes just because people aren't important doesn't mean they don't have important things to say. It usually does mean that, but that doesn't always
Not always. Happened. Not always. We're on a daily show here, General. So sometimes it's hit and miss here around the old Drinking Bros sets. We're thrilled to have you on. You got a new book out, Risk, A User's Guide. First of all, welcome to the show. What made you write the book, sir?
Well, first, call me Stan, everybody, and thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Wrote the book because I had gone through my military career, be it taught risk and going through risk assessments and all that. Now, I'd been out for about 11 years, same sort of experience dealing with risk and coming to the conclusion that I and we as organizations don't do it very well. You know, for all the theory that's out there and the math and the probabilities, the actual way I've watched us make decisions and measure the risk and take that into account, it's pretty subjective and often ineffective. And so really wanted to get my mind around that. So we spent a couple of years studying risk, and we were just starting the book when COVID-19 hit. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that COVID-19 became the case study that almost proved our point more than anything else.
And when you're saying us as a nation or as a military?
Well, I guess in terms of our book, whenever I use the term us, I mean my co-author and I, Anna Patrico, a young lady who is terrific, young Vanderbilt grad. When I think about us, when I refer to that larger, I tend to talk about the nation as sort of a big organization.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear you say that because Dan and I say that all the time. You almost have to run it like a business these days, like an organization. Otherwise, you have what you have going on here where it's kind of, you know, to your point about COVID, it feels kind of lawlessness where, or lawless, I should say. You look around and certain cities have certain laws and then the governor ends up suing to say those laws are no good.
Right.
The president is asking for different laws and suing states for different things.
Well, like this is the way our government's set up intentionally by the framers of the Constitution, right? The 9th and 10th Amendment to give state rights to push back against federal authority. But in some cases, I guess it doesn't make sense, right? I mean, and that isn't to say that we should just accept whatever the federal government says. That's all I'm saying. I'm saying the system itself doesn't make sense sometimes.
Right.
When lives are on the line, we drop all mannerisms and decor and get the fucking job done. That's what we did as soldiers. That's what we do. Right. There's no more, hey, sir, there's fucking people over there. It's like, hey, there's fucking people shooting.
Right.
Whoever you are, it doesn't matter what your rank or title is at that point. And there are certain instances where some of this stuff has to be, all the pride and ego and posturing and positioning that happens in American politics it's like hair clogging a drain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we saw it with FEMA in 2006. It was terrible. I wrote a paper on that in college. It was an absolute nightmare what they did down there. And ultimately what they decided to do was, hey, why are we trying to stand up an entire federal government apparatus to do something that Walmart and Amazon have already perfected?
Right.
Why don't we just contract them to handle this situation? You know what I mean? Very small little tidbits like that to keep the supply chain going, or in this case, to keep medical research going, or whatever it is.
Right.
You know what I mean? That shit makes sense, and we seem to be really bad at it. I would like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, why do you think we are bad at it?
Well, it's interesting. I think we're bad at it because we worry so much about external threats that we don't look internal at our own capability and the health of our organizations to get stuff work, to make stuff work. I'm really struck by what you say. Government across the United States, in some form or fashion, governance has to work. Now, part of that is federal, part of that is state, part of that is local. But at the end of the day, the trash has got to get picked up. You've got to have clean water. You got to get kids educated. There's got to be a common defense. There are certain things upon which society is dependent, and it has to work. And as you described, it's a good analogy, hair in the drain. When we are our own worst enemy, when we cause ourselves problem, and that's really what we came out in the book. The conclusion is the greatest risk to us is us.
Yeah, and when we look at what's going on right now, and this is an assumption, I have not read the book yet. I imagine you didn't plan for this Afghanistan pullout to happen right as the book was coming out, or you wrote it just right after and kind of raced it out like most of these Trump books are right now.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I coordinated all that to go in right order. No, I have
So the New World Order is just General Stanley McChrystal. You've been the guy the whole time and nobody knew it. Holy shit.
Because when you put out a book like this and you are who you are, the first assumption is going to be, oh my God, is it going to tell us what went wrong in Afghanistan? It was like, hey guys, I'm not that smart and I couldn't see into the future. That's what you're saying?
Well, I'm not saying I'm not that smart. I mean, we started the book right before COVID hit, and then COVID ends up being this incredible case study of what happens, but we had no clue it was going to arrive. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's wild, right? Because people don't understand how long it takes to write a book. It is climbing up a mountain every single time. I've done it a few times, and it's...
Man. Yeah, but you guys did primary research for this book,
yeah,
too. If you're doing actual data collection, that's a whole other shit show, because you have to collect the data,
yep,
and then process it, and then... I mean, I'm not going over the five C's of intelligence or anything, but collect and then process the intelligence or the data, and then send it off to get peer-reviewed and stuff like that. It's a whole... That must have taken 3 or 4 years itself, right?
This book took us 2 years, but it was leaning in pretty hard. And as you'll notice, it's not going to be as thick a book as some of the previous ones. So it's a, whenever somebody says, yeah, write a book, I say, yeah, have at it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. Or if somebody says, hey, can you help me with my edit? No, I can't actually, but I can refer you to Tucker Max's company and have them do it. But yeah, it's a tedious process and it's never ending. And since we're talking about Afghanistan, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your thoughts on the mess that has happened over there.
Yeah, I'm going to give several layers to it. First off, I'm obviously not happy about it. Spent a lot of my time over there. A lot of us spent a lot of ourselves over there. So clearly, I'm unhappy with the outcome. I've been asked if it's a failure, and there's no way to argue that it was a success. So from that standpoint, yeah, it's a failure. On the other hand, I don't think that much of what was done was wasted. There was a lot of work done that helped Afghanistan society, females to get in school, young people for 20 years had opportunities to move that country forward. So the Afghanistan that the Taliban now control is not the Afghanistan they gave up in 2001.
100%, yeah. And you can't unring that bell for those young kids either. That's what they know now. So it's one thing to, and we experienced this in Iraq a lot as well. Some people have been at bent knee for so long, they don't know how to stand on their own anymore. This is an entire generation and a half, really, that now knows what that feels like. And it's hard to go back, honestly. It really is.
Which I think is critical. So I think there's a sadness to it. People ask me whether I would have taken this course of action. The answer is no, I wouldn't have. I probably left some force there because I think it would have been a good investment. But I'm also honest enough to tell you, I'm very biased. I'm probably not the person they should ask to make that decision because of my bias. But I think, you know, I think there's a future. It's going to be painful for a while. I think painful for the Taliban, too, as they try to get their arms around this thing. But I think Afghanistan will move forward. I just think there's too much pressure there from the young generation.
Right. Do you think what do you see as the parallels between the Taliban taking over now in Afghanistan and sorry, this is a bit wonky for the audience, but that and then the Palestinian government being won by Hamas in 2006 and their complete inability to govern at all. Right. It wasn't even a matter of having to use authoritarianism to govern. They just couldn't figure out like basic plumbing and shit like that.
Yeah, I think there's every likelihood that'll be the case. I mean, we watched the Taliban rule before, and it wasn't pretty. I suspect that they are going to run into the same thing. But I think the external or international community is going to be much less tolerant this time, because this time the Taliban aren't pushing the group out they did the first time, the warlords and whatnot. This time, a lot of the international community has been closer to Afghanistan. So I think there's going to be a lot more difficult economic discussions, right, financial discussions, which pressure them.
I mean, is this just turning into a proxy Cold War with China at this point? Not just between the U.S. and China, but between the West in general and China. I mean, there's so many competing interests for resources in that area.
Yeah, I don't think Afghanistan is. I do think there's an increasing competition with China, and you could call it a Cold War. I don't really think China cares much about Afghanistan. There are some resources there, but I think they're overblown, to be honest. And they're very expensive to extract because the lack of infrastructure on the ground. So my guess, feeling is China's happy that the United States is off their flank there. But beyond that, I don't think they think this is a huge deal.
It's interesting you say that. You're the first one that has actually said that. And it makes sense because, looking back at it, going into that country, everybody has said how difficult it was from the get-go. I didn't even think about trying to extract minerals from the rare earth minerals from the ground.
It's like North Vietnam. I mean, people have been trying to conquer that place for some time now. And there's a lot of Western bodies buried in the fucking dirt in these countries. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Quite a bit. And it is what it is. I mean, they fight hard. They fight a longer war than we do. I make this analogy sometimes. It's like, we're playing like this. These wars are a football game, and we think the game's over at halftime, but these guys just keep playing, right? There's no end in sight for them. And I think it's something I talked to Brett Weinstein and his wife about yesterday. There's this in American culture these days. It used to be that people would focus like your number one goal in life, which if you take it back to just straight up biology, your number one goal in life is to propagate your DNA, and not just propagate it, but propagate it as far into the future as possible. Brett added that to my statement, which I agreed with. Now it seems like people's goals in life, I'm going to get this job, make this amount of money, then I'm going to retire, then I'm going to do this. And we're not thinking 1, 2, 3 generations in a row. And I'm not saying we should necessarily. I'm just saying there is something to be said for that process, right? Yeah, China's ability it's resilience ultimately to withstand the pressure of time, I think, is a big part of foreign policy. And it's a part that we have a problem with intrinsically because we have a peaceful change of power for 4 years. So I'm not saying we shouldn't have that, but it is something we haven't addressed very effectively. I mean, when's the last major policy piece that transferred from one White House to the next, particularly when they change parties? I mean, I don't know when the last time that happened was.
Yeah, it's interesting because until about 20 years ago, foreign policy used to be fairly consistent across different administrations. Nowadays, it jinks and jives, which I think is a real mistake. You go back to Afghanistan. One of the impressions that a lot of people need to understand is Afghanistan was always no man's land. It was between Russia in the north and British-controlled India in the south. And if you flew over Pakistan like I did, and then fly to the Afghan border, all of the railroad lines and major roads stop. I mean, they literally stop. There were no railroad lines in Afghanistan at all until we built the first leg up in the north of about 50 kilometers in 2010.
Holy None. Shit, that's so crazy.
You can't do mining without railroads. And so because of the amount. So people, when they talk about it, the other thing I'd like to throw out is, people talk about the big winners in this war being Pakistan. I differ with that. I think the problem with that Pakistan will have now is they'll be increasingly irrelevant because
especially the side of the ISI that is pro Taliban, right? Because they don't have anybody to take bribes from or cover up for anymore. So what's their job now?
Yeah,
I'm not asking you to co-sign on that statement, but we know for as close to a fact as you can be that members of the ISI coordinated the Mumbai terror attacks from Pakistan. And they also had Bin Laden sleeping a mile down the street from their version of West Point. So you know, there's a lot of bullshit going on in that country. That country we fund.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. Oh. Well, I mean, I certainly wouldn't argue with much of that, but if you think about it, Pakistan was very relevant during the Cold War because of their position strategically. Then they were very important to us from 2001 to 2021. Nowadays, I think they're going to have a tough time getting the United States to return their phone calls because they're just not a place that's critical to us. And of course, India's economy and capacity is growing so much that that competition's becoming lopsided. So I think Pakistan is going to find itself in a less effective position to leverage any power they do have.
How would you have done it differently? Looking at it from the outside,
wait, before we get onto that, I have a question. This is another wonky one, but if Pakistan is weak in that region, does that mean we need to keep a closer eye on India? Because they're kind of like, it's kind of like a counterbalance there. You know what I mean? You guys, we'll give you the same amount of shit and you guys figure it out.
And their rivals in cricket too.
Yeah, big time. Yeah. Well, they have that that border ceremony every year. Have you ever seen that shit? It is wild as hell. Yeah. I want to go to that sometime, to be honest. Yeah,
absolutely.
But not looking like this, because I'm too white for that. But do you think that India becomes a problem at that point?
I don't think. I mean, if India is going to become a problem, it'll become separate from Pakistan. I think Pakistan's not a counterbalance to India now. It's too lopsided. Competition now. Pakistan just can't keep up because they're not big enough.
Right.
They're not
strong enough. What's India got? 1.3 bill, something like that.
Yeah, they got 1.3 billion people there. Yeah.
What were you going to?
I was asking how would you have done it differently with the pullout in general? Because look, a lot of people are asking that question, but we actually get to ask a general about it. So I don't have to ask in general. I get to ask a general about how you would have done it differently.
The general in Afghanistan.
Correct. Right? Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, this is really dangerous because I'm not there. I didn't have all the intelligence, et cetera. So I can say everything now with no risk of being proven wrong.
Correct.
So
yeah. That's fair. Let me hit you with a hypothetical. Would you have, for example, before you pulled out all of your citizens, green card holders, and SIV applicants, abandoned Bagram Air Base, lie to the president of Afghanistan about it, pull all your troops out of the airport there in Kabul, and then have to redeploy the DRF-1 for the 82nd Airborne and a Marine Mew to resecure the area, and then also turn down the Taliban's offer to let the United States military control the entire city of Kabul during that out processing? I'm guessing probably no to all of that.
Yeah, look closely at me so you can see me ignore that question. Let me just frame to remind listeners, though. Remember, there was a date certain set by the Trump administration when they negotiated the Doha Accords. So that date was set. President Biden had two choices. He could either throw that agreement out and extend the war, which was unlikely given his opinion on it, or he could try to stick with it. He did extend it a bit, as you saw, but it was a tough situation. So assume that the decision to pull out completely is made and you're not going to revisit that decision. Then the question of how you do it.
Yeah, we're fine with that, by the way. I thought we were, if we had done what you said back in 2009 in Afghanistan, it would have been a different story. But another decade after that, this war was done. Right. So we are in complete agreement about that now.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that with you.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, the question on getting out, the only thing I'd say is you can't judge a decision by the outcome always, because you make a decision on two criteria, in my opinion. One, the values that you're about.
Right.
And the second is the probability of success.
You're talking about risk management here, right? I mean, this is the book. This is the book right here.
That's right.
Okay.
And they made the decision to try to withdraw forces rapidly. And they couldn't be sure that the Afghan military or government was going to collapse as quickly as it did. I wasn't surprised it collapsed quickly, but I mean, that was kind of amazingly fast.
Right.
So if everybody had gotten out sort of elegantly, we might be sitting here going, boy, that was really smooth.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard for me to find fault with the guys on the ground. I know all the senior leaders are on the ground, and they're to a person, they are good people, really talented leaders.
Right.
So I'm just
Well, we knew, though, quite a bit ahead of time that it was already collapsing, right? By the time things started to go public, I think, what was it, around the 7th or something like that, 40-some percent of the country was already taken over by the Taliban, right? So we knew at least some part into that. I think that's when you're talking about risk management, I mean, we can use all the military acronyms and about failing to plan and shit like that, but really it's there's hope. One, hope is not a game plan. Like, I hope this is going to work. We're just going to try this. You don't sprint up the middle with foreign policy. You just can't do that, right? So there had to be some kind of backup plan. Like, what happens if they're pushing too hard? Because the agreement was that we're going to pull our people out if you stop fucking around, right? Well, there's no attacks, and there weren't any attacks up until relatively recently. So if the agreement extends to that date, then it extends to that date. If you guys keep attacking us, we're going to run sorties and Spectre gunships through that place until you stop. You know what I mean? I mean, that seems like a pretty decent rebuttal. I'm not asking you to armchair quarterback. I'm just saying it seems like there wasn't some kind of plan like that to back it up, because they just continued with what they were doing. And I don't know if that's just pressure from their side of the party or whomever, just to get the fuck out of there and try to cut losses. I mean, I understand that logic, but that doesn't really work. You know what I mean? When the enemy's already on the advance, you have to stop them. Like, if you were running away from somebody, if you do run, hide, fight classes with the FBI, and a person gets close, you do whatever damage you can to them and move again, mm-hmm. right? That's the whole point. Or it's like a baited ambush where I'm setting up machine guns on either side and running my guys down the middle and lighting up the inside. You know what I mean? We fucked this up pretty badly. I just want to know what your thoughts are, why we didn't pivot at any point.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be quite blunt with you. I don't think pivoting was much of an option, because if you pivoted, you'd have been in combat.
Right.
You're buying into to doing that again. Once you start killing people again, they start killing you. You're in the war again.
Right.
And so I'm quite sure that there was a reticence to do that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we definitely didn't want it to go hot again. I just think, let's move beyond the armchair stuff and go to something that a lot of people have wondered about. And one of the big criticisms for some of your colleagues on the ground were that they didn't inform this administration or the last exactly how maybe incompetent, or not necessarily incompetent, but incompetent without our air support, the Afghan army would really be. And that's not my understanding. Honestly, my understanding is I've spoken to a lot of these people and I've seen some of the reports. They have been warning about that eventuality for a good time, like since 2016, I believe, before the 2016 election. So during Obama's administration. What happened there? I mean, did we severely underestimated the Taliban's ability to move quickly? And we also overestimated the Afghan army's ability to stand up without our air support, right?
Well, I don't know at the end, but let's talk about that dynamic there. Mm. First, there's the dynamic of you give people a mission over a period of years. They try to do that mission. They become wedded to that mission. They believe in that mission. It's kind of like asking a coach of a college football team if they're going to win on Saturday. If the coach looks at it and says, "Nah, I don't think so," it's self-fulfilling. So you don't want that coach anyway. So right. The first thing is there is a tendency, and I'm watching a lot of clips on TV where they show generals saying, "Yeah, we think we're making progress." What do you expect them to say?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure.
All right. But the other side is, did we know? I think leaders were very aware of the limitations of the Afghan military. And I would say that don't try to separate the Afghan military and the government. I've spoken to a number of Afghan military since this happened, and they all talk about losing faith in the government. Now, to a degree, they're probably trying to pass the buck a little bit. But the reality is they feel that the government, President Ghani, let them down, which undercut the commitment of the Afghan military.
Right. I mean, that's
the answer. Yeah.
He fled the country, so I don't think there's any.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he definitely did that. There's a question about that. Do you think the assessments being made about the capabilities of the Afghan army, I guess to some degree you don't, because you think there's some deflection being made by not associating the government with them. But do you think, like, regardless of how well we train them to fight, a dynamic guerrilla force with air superiority over them. And then we remove the air superiority and that changes things. I mean, you have been a soldier for a very long time, and at no point during your life has any country had air superiority over the United States, and that makes a difference on the battlefield. I was in the 82nd Airborne as an infantryman, and I know exactly what kind of difference that can make, and our small unit teams know to an even greater degree. I feel in a big way, like I know there's a lot of shitbags in the Afghan army and whatever fucking indigenous force we ever train, but there's a lot of hard fighters over there too. And I feel like they're getting a bad rap because we took away the thing that mattered most and then judged them based on how they reacted to that with the government collapsing around them. I think the Afghan army itself, I think, is taking way too much heat.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. As you know, air power is an operational thing, but it's also a morale thing.
Yep.
It's the scent. There's a confidence that comes with it.
Mm-hmm. It's like jumping off the side of the bed, and you know your dad's going to catch you. You know what I mean? Me and my 8 or 12 guys could go out in the middle of nowhere and do some shit because I know ISR is flying around, and I know there's a gunship on station if I need it. That's a big confidence boost, and it allows you to take risk. And we just, at the Afghan, it seems like the Afghan army basically collapsed on their whatever fortifications they had in all these areas throughout the country. And then in the absence of leadership, they did exactly what the Soviets did at the end of the Cold War. They just abandoned stuff. And the generals sold all the shit. You know what I mean? I mean, why would we expect any different? It just happened in the 1990s.
No surprise there. And as I'm told, the Taliban went in each of those provinces, and they basically just went to the Afghan military and they said, this province is going to fall. Mm. You got two choices. You can fight or you can just switch now, just surrender. And, you know, the logical thing to them to do in those areas was to give up.
Well, what do you think is going to happen? What's the future of Afghanistan look like here?
Yeah, that's what I can't figure out either. Because once you leave like this and the Taliban takes over, how is it any different than what we entered into to begin with?
Yeah, and before you answer that question, I want to address the fact that this ISIS-K or alleged ISIS-K involvement and stuff going around in Afghanistan right now, all those dudes were in jail and it was the Taliban that let them out. So I don't know if there's any, you know, confluence of effort between the two at all, but that's not great.
Right? No.
Shit.
No.
So anyways, yeah, what do you think about that?
A couple things. One, on whether it'll become a terrorist sanctuary. You know, on the one hand, potentially, but to create Tarnak Farms again and the kind of base that Al-Qaeda had before 2001, I don't think so, because there's too much capability for U.S. reconnaissance and air power to pick up that kind of a footprint.
Right.
Now, can they operate on a lower level in built-up areas? The answer is yes. But that doesn't make that any more dangerous to us than other parts of the world where Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other entities are operating too. So I don't think that that particular threat is huge. I think that the Taliban are going to struggle to control the country because they're the Taliban. At the end of the day, they have some severe limitations. Mm. They don't have a tremendous amount of imagination or breadth of intellect or any of those things. And I think they're going to run into this changed Afghan society on the one hand, a harder line from the international community, and internal, as you guys well know, the internal groups in the north and whatnot are not natural allies of the Taliban, the former Northern Alliance elements. Mm. So as soon as they get an opportunity, they'll become a challenge for them.
Yeah. You think any chance the north and south just split or some fracture of the country? I mean, to be honest, from my experience, I'm not sure the Northern Alliance is capable of running a government either, frankly. I mean, it's 2021. We judge things based on how we live our American lives every day, but that's just not how it is in a lot of places in the world. And they still seem to function more or less without some of the utilities we do. So I'm not saying they couldn't do it, but it seems unlikely that either one of these groups is capable of doing that.
They will both struggle. I don't think they'll formally split. Like you say, I'm not sure they could formally form two real countries there. You know, I used to be struck by in Mogadishu. Remember, there was no government at all.
Yeah.
There were still cell phones.
Yeah.
There were still hotels. You know, yeah. How does that work?
It's wild. Yeah, that's a weird place. That's a Jane Goodall should go there and do like a how this is what ultimate quote unquote libertarianism looks like. You can do whatever you want. This is what was the name of the city that Wyatt Earp was in? And
Tombstone.
Oh, that's the name of the city, Tombstone. Yeah, it's like Tombstone, but modern day. Like it's the Wild West there. It's crazy as shit. But I can't. I mean, I can't imagine that Afghanistan's gonna turn into that. I mean, people have been working. That's one of the other things we talked about. Not just the access to education and stuff like that, but regular employment and the idea that workers have rights, like that there's a schedule that you only work X amount of days, that you get paid this amount for this kind of work, that is now kind of embedded into the infrastructure of that country. And that's going to, it will find, so maybe they're in like the early 19th century, base, like America before the labor movement, shit like that. Now, obviously, it's a lot more complicated, but it wasn't like America wasn't violent in the early 19th century. You know what I mean? We were fucking up each other quite a bit, as a matter of fact. So, who do you think are best? I think Jordan is probably one of our better allies in the Middle East. I just, their intelligence community is very, very good. They seem to not fuck us over too much as compared to some of the other ones. And I would like to hear your thoughts on our allies in that region and maybe some thoughts on what the region's going to evolve into over the next couple of years as things, you know, kind of, look, we've shaken up the snow globe now, and now the snow has got to resettle. So let's see where it goes, right? I just want to know what you think is going to going to happen there.
That's great question. You're right. I think we shook it up for sure. I think we got outcomes we didn't really expect. We pulled the keystone out when we took out Saddam Hussein. And he wasn't a good guy, but it was that balancing act between Iran's power and then the Sunni side. So my feeling is countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which have traditionally been allied with us because it was in their interest,
right,
are still going to be allied with us, but less fervently. They are going to try to recalculate what's life with a less reliable American partner. And I don't think they'll partner with the Chinese, but they'll be looking to have a balance against Iran because Iran is going to be a regional power. It already is, and it will continue to be a regional power because historically that just tells you. Plus, they're very aggressive. So my sense is you're going to end up with this increasingly bipolar Shia-dominated Iran on one side, and then the Sunnis probably led by Saudi Arabia, although traditionally Egypt is the 800-pound gorilla. They've just been going through trouble. But I think that the Sunni part of the Mideast has got to regularize itself. They've got to get aligned again. They've got to get, well, they've got order in Egypt, but Egypt's got to get on a level move. Jordan is a good partner to us, but they're not powerful in the region.
Right.
They're not otherwise relevant. So you really need Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and to a degree UAE to do that.
What are your thoughts on how to do that? I mean, get them involved in some kind of business or something. I mean, what do you do there? Like, because look, if you go down to the very base level to Maslow, you can see what this hierarchy of needs. But you also add in, we all know that the devil, our idle hands, are the devil's whatever the fuck, right? I mean, that's, people need shit to do. Otherwise, they sit around a bitch and go stand in traffic and protest and shit. People need things to do. And one of the huge issues with the Iraq war, right, was we got there and just told all the Iraqi army guys to go home. You know, that was a huge mistake. So what do you think is the solution to that with a country like Egypt? Because it's got to be Egypt. It can't be Saudi Arabia. There's too much history there. It's got to be Egypt. Because of geographically where they're located.
Yeah. Well, Americans hate this, what I'm about to say, but the reality is we've got to help their societies build themselves up. Areas of instability work against us. We are best postured in the world when you have countries that have employment, have opportunity. One of the big recruiting tools for Al-Qaeda in Iraq was that group of young Arab men, Islamic men, who had no opportunity politically, economically, socially. They couldn't get married because they didn't make enough money. And so they're living in fairly repressive political regimes in many cases in North Africa and other countries. So you create this boiling pot with a top on it, and the steam's going to build up. So we have got to continue to lean forward to try to get those autocratic regimes to improve their behavior so that they get their populations in a better sense.
Do you think that strategy has worked in Saudi Arabia as we've continued to do business with them? I mean, I haven't looked at the data recently, but the last time I did, about 80% of their primary education schools were still madrasas. I mean, that's still a big problem, right? And it's, but they some things have happened. Actually, Uber, because it's the Saudi royal family owns part of it, pressured Saudi Arabia into allowing women to drive. And I know that seems stupid, but in September 2019, they finally had to, in the first time in their history, allow women to drive because they wanted to make money. Money is a good incentive for people. And it does seem like, here's the way I would frame the question, because I understand why people don't like what you just said, but I agree with you. Here's the way I would frame the response to that. Would you rather spend some money with some less than ethical people and do whatever you can to improve the lives of the people now, but also into the future, and give them a reason to stop their bullshit? Or do you want to send our sons and daughters to go fight these motherfuckers? Because it's going to be one of those two things eventually, on a long enough timeline, over a 20 to 40 year timeline, one of those two will happen. So what do you want to do?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. I think Saudi Arabia is one of the countries over there that absolutely understands it. Mohammed bin Salman's a clever young man. Mm-hmm. He's a little bit hard-edged, as you've seen how he's arrested some of his competitors and cut up one of his detractors. But the reality is he knows they've got to move that population along and get them jobs and have them actively engaged in their own society. They can't just keep everybody on the dole with oil because it's too brittle.
Right.
And so I think that they will move. The question is, do they have an upset before then? I can't predict that.
GhostBed.com/drinking bros. Sleep so good, it's scary. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. They got a 35% off sale now. They bumped it up 5% for the ghosts for Halloween. Again, take advantage of them. I think they did finally take down the 40% off, though. And it was, you know, usually it's 30% on the show with the promo code Drinking Bros at checkout. And it still is. If you want a singular item, congratulations, do that. But right now, there is a flash ghost sale for Halloween of 35% off at ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. So if you need pillows, sheets, a mattress, an adjustable base, whatever you can possibly fathom that your bedroom needs, that's what they got there. And they've got the best in the biz. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today. Where, as always, they got a 36-month pay-as-you-go program. No interest there if you have decent credits. And they'll allow you to use those deals, the 30% off, the 35% off deals with that program. And it's $35-$38 a month at the end of it, dude, when you check out. Boom, congratulations, 36 months, no interest. Go, get yourself a mattress, be a real human being. And then last but not least, I'll just give them a shout out because they're here, you hear them at the top of the show, Cardomax.com. That is cardomax.com. Use the promo code DB for 30% off your next four orders. I'm drinking it now. I'm actually got the immunity booster this afternoon because I get all jacked up on their energy intensifier today. You'll see it. It's always on the desk here. This is the blue raspberry and the pink lemonade. Gigantic fan of cardomax.com. That is CardoMax.com. Promo code DB for 30% off your next four orders. Old school drinking bro, Sean Mattson, it's his new company. Homie, lover, friend, former Navy SEAL, and it is a veteran-owned company, so support promo code DB at cardomax.com, 30% off your next four orders. That'll get you jacked up in the morning, and then the immunity booster I'm just taking now, and I really like it. Shout out to Sean, dude. This is fucking great. Congratulations on the new company. You're a popular guy, by the way. I hear your text messages going off in the background. Is that your wife back there? She texting away?
That's my wife.
She sent a thumbs up to somebody that came across the screen. Nah, I just want to...
That's on the chat thing on Zoom. I think.
That's on the phone. You guys going out partying tonight? Where are you at?
They're in New York. Can't party.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, we're in New York City. I'm doing this book rollout this week. So.
Oh, wow. Are you guys coming to... dinner tonight. Oh, great. Yeah. Are you guys so you're going to do a book tour around the country or what?
Well, we're doing a lot of virtual stuff. We're doing a little bit around the country just because COVID still holds you up. We'll go to San Francisco, a couple other areas, but mostly virtual now.
Yeah. Well, if you come out to Austin, let us know. We'll definitely come out and bring a lot of our fans out.
That'd be fun.
They're big fans of you, obviously. I mean, we haven't really... we haven't danced around. We just haven't brought up the gorilla. What you're most known for most Americans is being the real life Brad Pitt, right?
Yeah. Right. I look, and this is the first time.
A better looking Brad Pitt.
In the history of the world that I think I have something in common with a 4-star general. Ever. This is going to sound crazy. We both got fired because of Rolling Stone. We threw a party in college and we were unaware that there was a Rolling Stone reporter. He came in and said, "Hi, I'm a Rolling Stone reporter." And he looked like a 40 something year old man at a party. And I was like, we thought it was a joke. And we were like, "Come on in." So we made the mistake of giving this guy full access to a party one night. And we subsequently got thrown off campus, fired. Everything was nuked for 5 years. And it was one of the worst decisions of my life. Right. With you, when you went out with this guy, because we had some friends of ours, one of our co-hosts is one of the owners of Black Rifle Coffee. Mm. They did a story with the New York Times. When you went out with a guy from Rolling Stone, was there any part of you that was just like, man, I don't know if I should give this interview?
You know, it's funny you should say this, because he was one of several freelancers who was around doing one of these embedded things coordinated. And I had to go to Europe. So I go to Europe with my team. This guy comes there and my wife flies over to join us for a few days. And my wife, who's sitting right behind me now, goes, "Has anybody vetted this guy?" Mm. And I said, "Yeah, I'm sure my press team has." And she did a Google search and she says, "You know that the last guy this guy did this with, he nuked him." You know?
Yeah.
And this was halfway through the period he was interacting with. I said, "Well, he won't do that to us because we're really good guys." And yeah. And then I had to go to this. Well, we went to this dinner. I took my wife for our 33rd anniversary. And afterward, we went to this bar where my command team was. They just asked us if we'd stop by. So we stopped by there and the author's there. And we leave the bar. And my wife goes, "I'm really glad that guy was there. The reporter was there." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because he will see what a real team who's been at war together for years looks like." And so we kind of walked out thinking that that's the portrayal he'd give. And all right, well, he didn't.
Yeah. And it's weird, right? Like, did they give you any heads up of the article? Because for mine, we did not. And it just showed up in print 4 months later, I think, after the guy was there. Unannounced, no nothing. And then, oh my God, this happened. And holy shit. Was that your exact sentiment when this happened, where you were like, "Oh my God, holy shit, this is not at all what I thought this was going to be"?
Yeah, I mean, a version of that. I was asleep. It was about 2 a.m. in Afghanistan, and the article had been already passed around the White House, apparently. Mm. And my military system woke me up, and he goes, "Sir, I got to talk to you." I said, "Why?" He said, "The Rolling Stone article came out." And I said, "That wasn't a serious article. That was just going to be, you know, this guy seeing how command team worked." He says, "It is." I went down at 2:30 a.m, read it. And as soon as I read it, I said, "This is going to be politically explosive." Mm-hmm. So, but no inclination before that.
Did you know that you were going to lose your job so quickly afterwards? Because what was it, 48 hours later, something like that, after the article came out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I read that article and I knew within 40 minutes that it was going to be that big a problem. And so, you know, when I flew back to the U.S., I carried my resignation in my pocket to offer it to the president. I said, "If you want me to stay and lead, I'm happy to do that. If you want me to give you my resignation, I'm happy to do that." Mm. Happy didn't what wasn't what I was trying to say, but I said, "Sir, perfectly happy with." And he was great about it. And he says, "Yeah, I'll accept it."
Oh, really? No conversation of, "Look, maybe we can salvage this," or "Let's talk to some of the White House aides and maybe put a statement out"? Nothing like that. It was that cut and dry with the president.
Yeah. I mean, he asked me when I went in very professionally, you know, what happened. I said, "I don't know. I haven't had time to investigate this, but I accept responsibility for anything that's written about my organization because I'm in charge."
I mean, but you knew what happened. What happened was a bunch of soldiers were bitching. That's what we do. I was telling somebody this the other day. It could be 72 degrees outside and sunny, and I could have a Mai Tai in my hand, and if there's another infantry dude sitting next to me, I'd be like, "Man, this fucking sand is bullshit. Can you believe this?" We would find a reason to either bitch or throw shit at each other.
Yeah.
Like rocks or pine cones. Go to any training site on Earth that has U.S. military personnel, and they will be throwing shit at one another. This is what we do. But and that's really, I mean, the press thing is really irritating. I mean, if they, I feel like it was a mistake to let that terminate your command by the administration, because it's one, it would be one thing if it was like sexual assault or something like that that's victimizing somebody. But soldiers sit around bitching. That is what they do. And when we, every time we as a society make major decisions where we pretend like something doesn't exist, it's a mistake, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's just dumb. It doesn't make any sense. And it, I don't know. Didn't they read Generation Kill? That's another Rolling Stone guy.
Yeah.
He wrote it the way it happened too.
Yeah.
But because it's Marines and combat, then it's not that, that somehow you think these two things are different. No, these are high stress jobs.
Yeah.
Where you're working 18 hours a day, maybe more sometimes. And it sucks.
Yeah. And now, Stan, I'm gonna look at glass half full on this one, okay? And I know that might be hard. Your wife, though, forever gets to tell her friends that Brad Pitt played you in a movie, and that's pretty much a mic drop at that point.
Did she go around the house and tape Brad Pitt's face to all the family photos and stuff afterwards?
You know, I haven't seen the movie.
Oh, really?
No, and it's on purpose because they never contacted me when they decided to make it. They never contacted me when they were making it. I figured he might. I knew that they were. I thought he might want to meet me and see if he could act like me.
Mm.
And then about a week before it came out, they called me and offered me a private showing.
Mm.
And I said, well, do I want to see it? Is it, you know, is it even-handed? And they go, well, you know, we're trying to make a statement. I said, well, all right, I don't need to see it. And so I never had.
Right. I don't think the statement that it makes, it would offend you personally. I don't think so. I think it was a pretty well done movie. I mean, obviously it's a bit of satire added into the mix, you know, caricatures of actual human beings and stuff like that. But the part where a general officer, maybe perhaps the most important general officer in the United States, had to couldn't get the president or the whomever in the chain of command to pay attention to the reports you were sending up, that needed to be out there. And to me, that was the main point of the whole movie, to be honest. And that, and at the general officer corps, is kind of a meat grinder. You either say yes to politicians or you can get the fuck out. And I think we're seeing a little bit of that these days, because these general officers are becoming quite too compliant for my taste. Although I was an NCO in the 82nd, so I just want to fucking set shit on fire all the time. You know
how it is. What battalion were you in?
I was in 2325.
That was the one my brother was in. Oh, second, great. 325.
Yeah, I
was in 504.
Oh, yeah. Well, guess we have to fight now. I don't know what to
do. Yeah.
Can you imagine that shit?
Oh, be like, great.
Got in a fight with General McChrystal again.
Yeah.
He's like riding around a Harley in my neighborhood.
504.
Looking for you.
I know, look, speaking of politics, I know with the position that you had and everything else, people will ultimately tie you to a president, a party, everything else. When you were in there, I believe you said you supported Joe Biden. Do you still do that today, now that he is actually president? And I know that statement was made many years ago when he was the VP mm-hmm. for Obama. How do you feel about that today, or do you wish Trump would have been in for four more years?
Yeah, I do not wish President Trump had been in for four more years. I just was not comfortable with that.
Mm.
I'm very centrist in my political views. I'm probably a little bit conservative economically and a little bit liberal on most social issues. So I probably fall, you know, pretty much in the middle. But I think that you need steady leadership. You don't need brilliant leadership. You've been in units. You don't need a genius for your commander.
Right.
You need somebody with good values that will take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means they don't lie to you. And they may not make great decisions and everything, but they make them for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I can live with that.
Right. And what, if you don't mind me asking, which decisions that Trump made were you uncomfortable with? I wouldn't call myself a centrist. I'm not a huge fan of that word because it implies that the truth is somewhere in the middle, and that's not necessarily true, right? I mean, the truth is the truth, and it doesn't mean that it's right or left. It's just the truth. That doesn't necessarily imply center, but maybe I'm just being autistic about it. You know what I mean? Who knows?
Yeah, I think you might be on that one.
But I think you might be on the spectrum on that one is what he meant to say.
Yeah, but anyways, yeah, what was it about Trump that irked you, I guess, for lack of a better phrase?
Well, I have to trust the leaders that lead me. And President Trump's record, I mean, from when he was running on, of lying was just so constant. And it's one thing to say, yeah, all politicians lie. And to a certain degree, I get that. Mm. But not like he did. And not like he still is. And so to me, there's just a separate category for people with that kind of an issue.
Well, do you think it's that he lies more than other people or that he does it non-euphemistically?
No, I think he lies more than, certainly lies more than anybody I trust.
Right. What is there a specific lie we're talking about, if you don't mind commenting on that? Like what pops up specifically for you?
Well, we could start with, you know, if you want to start most recent with the stolen election, there's no data for that.
Yeah, I haven't seen any real evidence for that either. I mean, if people wanted to talk about how social media and the confluence of power behind the scenes with the left and that stuff, I'm all in on that because manipulating information, that's a tried and true method of making people do shit that's not in their best interest. I still haven't seen any real data that says if this and this and this had not been done, then the election would have gone the other way. I just haven't seen it. Right.
And here's your problem. The three of us can sit here and agree with that, have a very reasoned conversation about it, maybe even arrive at different conclusions. Mm. But there's a whole bunch of people who are very busy in life and don't have time to parse information, and they accept certain things that are put out. Not all from the right, some from the left, but they accept it. And when you lie, and it gets into that bloodstream, you got a bunch of people who are just misinformed.
Right.
That's really dangerous.
It certainly is.
Yeah. And is this why, because, you know, I know the New York Post wrote an article about you working with this group, Defeat Disinfo, helping them out. And people are trying to tie that back to your support for Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. What was the reason for advising them in this group?
Yeah. One, I didn't do very much, but I certainly wouldn't duck because I think I should do it. Mm. They were simply out there to identify and try to combat mis and disinformation. Mm. And to me, any organization that can do that openly, you know, entirely above board is a good thing. And we need to do a lot more of that.
And what did you identify exactly? Because I know they were using artificial intelligence to map out some of Trump's claims about vaccinations and things like that. What else was it being used for, and what were you specifically advising them on?
Well, again, I didn't have the expertise to do a lot of advice, so I don't want to make my role sound bigger than it was. But what they were doing is they could come and they could point out the use of bots and things by hard right groups that would spin things. You know, you start with a public pronouncement by the president, and then those get put into increasingly extreme channels, and they get amplified, and in some cases are corrupted, sometimes they're passed as is, and it becomes very, very negative thing. Mm. And I think that's got to stop. I don't know how we stop it completely, but if we don't get that under control, we could have the kind of instability in our nation that, you know, we haven't seen since the Civil War.
Right. It's interesting to think about possible solutions to that, because the auto-generated accounts from both Russia and China that spread quite a bit of misinformation, not just misinformation, but targeting our intellectual property and scamming people out of Social Security money and all kinds of other bullshit. I mean, it goes on constantly. And then, of course, there is the media doesn't have a very good reputation right now, because I don't know of any real media that somebody would call the media that is just saying the truth about things anymore. It seems like everybody's got a little bit of bend, or sometimes quite a bit of bend. They also are kind of really interested in one or two different narratives, and they push those constantly in the same way that you're talking about the robots are doing. The robots are just doing it a little bit more efficiently, probably, right? At least in social media. So here's my problem. How do you do anything about that without getting into people's civil rights? Because I honestly, if the rights don't hold up, if the right to speak and travel and be an entrepreneur and do what you want, the liberty that America guarantees doesn't exist because it's untenable in the current situation, then that means that the system of government is then untenable, right? Because if without the liberty that we're guaranteed, this isn't America. So I wonder, how do you affect things like that? Because I would never want to tell somebody, you can't say this. And I also don't want to tell them, you have to say something. So that's even more fucked up. And we're getting to that point now where we're trying to censor it. I don't know if there's an elegant solution to any of this.
I'm not sure there is, but there's certainly some things that we have to think about. Of course, the Supreme Court years ago decided that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater.
Right.
If somebody came and they started a campaign against your podcast and you two personally, as you know, they could make up stories, they could put things about you, some of which would be very ugly, and you are public figures now. Mm-hmm. And so it is hard to libel a public figure.
Right.
You know, and they could do things with doctored photographs, they could use your voice, they could take this recording, they could change what was said just by picking pieces of it with some pretty effective techniques, and you would feel very victimized. Mm. And you would be screaming, somebody's got to do something about this. And I would sympathize with you. But the point is, that's where we are. So we've got to a point where information technology has magnified the ability to do evil with something as innocuous as speech.
Right.
And so that's where it gets frightening.
Yeah, and disinformation, in my opinion, going forward is going to be the biggest thing that fractures our nation. And look, that's what everybody else wants in the world. And to your point, anyone can do it. And once it's out there and it's read, and if you are a public figure, that's it. Because people are just going to scroll through things, look at it real quick, and be like, oh, that guy's a rapist, or that guy's a this. And then move on with the rest of their day, but always thinking that thought. Happened with a buddy of mine in a law firm. They were suing this guy who was bilking money from his own company. And he hired some people. They had to trace this back, you know, through whoever, intelligence and all that other stuff. And it was a company in Bosnia who was like, hey, great, we can Photoshop this guy and make fake articles about everything else that, you know, he was arrested for domestic violence and everything else. My buddy wasn't even married, like nowhere near it, no wife, no nothing. And there's nothing you can do once it gets out there. And then you're in this endless fight to get it removed from the internet, let alone people's thoughts, once it's ingrained in their minds. And I don't know how to combat it, like Dan was saying, because some of these things, there is a kernel of truth in there. And it's like, who is the ultimate judge and decider of what gets published or printed on the internet or what gets taken off? And I think that's a battle that we're going to be in for a very, very long time. Yeah. And I don't know what we do, to be honest. Either.
I mean, I don't understand. First of all, the red line of the sand is censorship. That can't be allowed for all the reasons that it can't be allowed. I don't think we need to go into that. But the other side is, there can't be nothing. There has to be something. There has to be some kind of element in place there to do. It's like gun laws. I don't want to hear this shall not infringe shit. Every single one of our listeners know at least one person that should not own a gun, right? Yep. And I'm not, that doesn't make anybody anti-gun. I'm glad I carry one every single day. But there is nuance in every single one of these conversations. So another thing we can't do is just force people to say stuff. You know what I mean? There's just so many intrinsic dangers in controlling language. And, it's been going on throughout. This isn't new, by the way. It used to just be that all the farmers and all the blue collar workers like us, we just didn't know how to read, right? So we didn't know anything. That was easy to manipulate, because you could just put out a flyer and have the town crier. That's the reason there was some fat dude standing in the middle of the city yelling shit from a piece of paper, is because nobody could fucking read.
Yeah, you know
what I mean? Yeah. That's why it was. So now we have, I guess as Neil deGrasse Tyson likes to say, we have smartphones and dumb people.
Yeah,
because we have completely lost the ability to take a piece of information and filter it through the Socratic method and come out with a result, yes or no. We cannot do that, especially not collectively, because it's just an echo chamber. Everywhere you go, you can't get a reasonable conversation these days between somebody who would identify as liberal and somebody who would identify as conservative, or even sometimes somebody that doesn't identify as anything, is impossible. Like, getting that to happen is really challenging. So I think, General, we disagree on quite a bit of things probably, but I really appreciate you talking to us like this, because honestly, it's getting harder and harder to get people who don't agree with you to talk to you about shit. And that's a huge mistake for this country.
I agree with that. I really appreciate y'all's time today. It was a pleasure.
No, it was a blast. And this is the point in the show. We get to the drinking bro of the week, which is someone who has inspired you or helped you become the person you are today. Who would you like to give the drinking bro of the week to?
Brad Pitt, obviously.
No.
I'd have to give it to my friend Mike Hall. He was my regimental sergeant major when I was a regimental commander. Then he was the sergeant major in Afghanistan. Came out of retirement to take that job.
Oh, wow.
Been one of my closest friends for much of my life.
That's great. I mean, you spend 18, 20 hours a day with that one dude for a long time at a time. That's a bond right there. That's great.
It is.
Yeah, and enjoy New York City. Look, all the publishers are there, so I'm sure, you know, they're meeting with you, doing the rounds, all that other stuff. And at least you get to have are the restaurants open and everything in New York right now?
They are.
Oh, now, great.
You have to be vaccinated to go in most of them. You have to prove it.
Yeah.
But they are.
That's fine.
You wait. Yeah. Do you have to show like a card or something? Is that when you make the reservation?
Do. Yeah.
Has no one sued the New York state government with a natural immunity claim yet? They won the case. That professor won a case at George Mason University, I believe it was.
I'm not sure.
I don't think anybody's even levied a complaint about any of that stuff yet, right?
No, but is there masks there, General?
Yeah, most people are in masks. Not everywhere, but, you know, yeah, about the same as I see anywhere else.
Is yours just like Brad Pitt's face?
All right, guys, I'm moving on. You have a great day.
You as well. Thank you. You too, sir. Take care. Do we just get a general to say thanks, guys? We're moving on. I'm getting the fuck out of here.
Yep.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. So I wanted to ask you, Dan, because obviously you served in the military. Mm-hmm. Was he there during your time, and did you actually know him? This is one of those things where I didn't want to ask him on air because obviously we have other things to discuss. Mm-hmm. And are you fans of generals in particular? Because, you know, a lot of our audience, Mattis, right? That was a rallying call for a lot of people. What about you and Stanley McChrystal?
I mean, I think he's a good man. I've never met him. I've never spoken to him before today. Obviously I know a lot about him just from, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so one of the things, if you watch the American Party episode with General Bolduc, I think 2 weeks ago, one of the things we talked about is a general officer corps and how it's been very politicized, and where if you're not a yes man, then you don't get promoted or you get launched out of the job you're in. Now, I don't think anybody on earth could question McChrystal's military competency. He is a very good leader, and his planning and execution of things in Afghanistan went very, very well. They asked him for a report. He went to do a report. What they wanted was, hey, you know, looks cool.
Everything's great. Yeah.
Pat on the back. Let's do this. Whatever the fuck. And he delivered a report that was like, no, we need about whatever 1,000 more people to come in here for a while, stabilize this shit, train these people, and then we can actually leave.
Yeah.
Right. And they basically told him to go fuck himself. And it's obviously satirized and dramatized in the film, but the chain of events were the same. And it's like, he was one of those dudes that knew he was probably going to catch a lot of flack and was risking his career and promotion and stuff for delivering an accurate report. And I respect that. I mean, even if he was wrong about it, which we'll never know now, but even if he had been wrong, that's still a lot more respectful than what we've been hearing lately, which is people who are afraid to tell the administration shit.
Right.
Right. And then the administration lying about it and the general's not having the stones to come back at him. That's fucking pussy bullshit to me. And if there's one thing he's not, it's a fucking coward. You know what I mean?
So just trying to wrap my head around this, is being a general then more about the political aspect of trying to keep your job and stay there?
Yeah.
Rather than you're on the battlefield every day?
Correct. I mean, look, you can, I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, but with the whole Russia Hillary thing, right? With trying to say Trump was tied to Russia, the entire time it was them doing this stuff.
With the Steele dossier.
Making up shit and accusing the other side of exactly what you're doing. You know what I mean? Stuff like that in politics makes me think people are capable of just about anything. So not to excuse any, if anything actually happened with the dude, but Deshaun Watson, it's weird how he took a hardline position and all of a sudden all of these people came out of the woodwork to attack him for something. That's the just too convenient. Life isn't that, life is messy. It is not that coordinated. It just doesn't, things don't happen like that. Life is chaos all the time. So when I see shit like that, and then I see this fucking Rolling Stone reporter, the way he described that interview was like that was just some ride-along person that was supposed to be... It, what it sounded like, the way he was framing it, talking about a war room execution or a general staff and see how they operate, was almost like they were doing a documentary, like a nerdy kind of, here's what it's like to be whatever the fuck. And that is kind of the same backdoor bullshit that this New York Times reporter pulled with Black Rifle. So they reached out, and the person wasn't even a full-time staffer with New York Times. They just write for him sometimes. And a lot of people sometimes write for the New York Times.
Yeah, freelancers.
A lot of people, a lot of conservatives write for the New York Times. This person was, they were doing the adaptive athlete challenge, the total archery challenge on, I think on Friday is the shoot. And then on the whole day, Saturday is made for adaptive athletes. So dudes that got dudes and women that got blown up fucking, leg shot off, go out and hunt or shoot arrows and shit, whatever.
And you're referring to the Black Rifle Coffee interview in the New York Times, right?
Yeah. So their press agent reaches out and says, hey, do you want to come? You're doing this event. We'd like to come check it out. And of course, Black Rifle's press team, not Evan or Matt or Jared or any of these guys, the fucking PR team says, yeah, of course, we want as much exposure on this veteran charity event as possible, because they were raising money for veteran charity. If you remember, I think it was Mountain Primal came here to give the boot campaign $100,000 around that same time. Yeah. So yeah, the person comes in and just like writes a hit piece on him, and it's the Gelman amnesia effect. People, all these conservatives, so-called conservative people or veteran supporters who know for a fact that the New York Times is a slimy, like left bent organization, didn't even take the time to wonder if Black Rifle was just caught up in some fucking sneaky bullshit, and they were being victimized by these assholes. The Gelman amnesia effect, the way I think it was Maria Konnikova that explained it to us, is where you're reading the New York Times stock section and you see something, you know, that's definitely not true. That's stupid.
Okay.
Then you turn the next page and you say, then you use it as a trusted source again.
Yeah.
You see advice on the page and you go do it. That's fucking stupid. So if you don't trust the New York Times, it's like your worst enemy, somebody that you know to be a liar, comes and tells you that their wife is cheating on you. You would believe that person only up to the ability to that they could provide evidence of that fact and no further. So that shit just fucking pisses me off.
Yeah, well, in this case, look, as far as the Rolling Stone thing, what I said was true. Now, in my case, what he wrote was accurate. we were partying and blah, 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 right? A lot of drugs and they weren't mine, but we got tossed and it was correct. Now, in his case, a lot of journalists and you know, having, again, majored in it and being a writer myself, I don't have this, but a lot of writers have this romantic notion of what war is, and they secretly want to be war journalists. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them want to do it without actually going to war and being a part of it or seeing it. And therefore, I believe this article and this interview took place in Ireland, if I'm not mistaken, with Mr. McChrystal. But there is this part of them that wants to be this war journalist and at least, you know, report on the truth and the facts and everything else. And it's like, no, in this instance, you were wrong. You got it wrong in this time. And you never really get to hear the other side of it. Now, you know, when we were asking him about why he got fired, and if there was some discussion of, hey, we can kind of salvage this and put you back out there. I'm surprised that doesn't happen more, but I guess at that time, it's ramped up now, but at that time that he was fired, that's when it really started to pick up social media wise and everything else, where a story like this that I didn't think was that bad. I don't know if you did, but I didn't think the story was bad at all.
Some people on his staff were talking shit about politicians.
Yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me? Go to any place where any military people, if there's two military people sitting next to each other, they will be bitching about something.
Yeah.
Probably American politicians.
Yeah.
Which is that's kind of a ridiculous thing. You could say that maybe, they could have conducted themselves more professionally, or his press team certainly could have done a better job, especially after his wife found out this dude has already done a hit piece on somebody. But, it all still does seem kind of fishy that Rolling Stone, which is a liberal rag, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I got it. You're anti-war. I got it. You want the clicks and the issues sold. Got it. But, over the last however many years now, since CNN flipped, since they turned on Bush, not that they were big pro-Bush guys before, but since they really started going hard after him, maybe like 2003, something like that, it has been the case that the left media tries to avoid embarrassing left people. And McChrystal is a Democrat, right?
Right.
Like he's, and I don't mean that in a negative way. He's been that way, I believe. I've been that way. he's felt more connected with the Democratic Party, I think, for the majority of his adult life. And it's reflected. He endorsed Biden, obviously not a huge fan of Trump. For the Rolling Stone to go after Biden's guy in Afghanistan, that's very bizarre to me. And the only thing that makes sense to me is that, look, the only way you get into the White House is if they allow you into there, into the press corps, right? They can fucking boot your ass out whenever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And they can ban certain people from the press corps. They can ban entire organizations from there. If you want to get access, you protect certain information and or you do them a favor. You're the first person. We hear all this shit with Jen Psaki all the time and all her bullshit. But the truly remarkable part that makes it obvious is when Biden's like, oh, they told me to ask you a question and then leave. You know what I mean?
Right.
They ask for that permission, and there's a proffer. There's some kind of quid pro quo there. Like, hey, even if it's unsaid, like, hey, you don't fuck us up too much and we'll do your thing. At the time, McChrystal was asking for 30,000 to 40,000 additional troops in Afghanistan, and that was not going to happen. Yeah. Obama said he was going to end that war. Obviously he didn't, but that was his goal in 8 years to end that war. And you're getting into that time where it's like, right when he took over, if you ran on the platform of hope, change, whatever, after we've been in war for 10 years almost at that point, and healthcare and blah blah blah, and one of your campaign promises is to get us out of Afghanistan, and the first thing you do in office is to put 40,000 more people over there, that's not going to work.
No.
Right? So I think this dude was taken down from the inside, and it's unfortunate, because regardless of what his political beliefs are, he seems to be a very honest man that doesn't cower when politicians come asking for shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that we lost
him. And you said something interesting too about, unless you're, victimized or something like that, or commit that, like, I think that's the standard in today's world. And I think if this article would have happened today versus 2011 or 10 or whenever it came out, I don't think he would have been fired. But just because of what we've gone through in the press for the last 10 years, you have to do something so egregious now to get fired. Even Cuomo, Jesus Christ, how long did that guy hang on?
Well, if you're somebody that the left likes, yeah, for sure.
Right.
But I agree with that. I think and I would have respected this move if he had done it. I think Biden should have walked out to a podium, cleared his throat, and said, so you're telling me a bunch of soldiers were bitching about American politics. All right, cool. I got to go take a shit.
Yeah.
This is what the fuck are we talking about? Oliver Stone has made a career on this. Are you fucking kidding me? This is not news.
Yeah.
And the Rolling Stone just wasted its money. I would have ridiculed the Rolling Stone for thinking that that's even relevant. And it was only relevant because their feelings were hurt and they had a different political agenda than McChrystal did. And let me rephrase that. He didn't have a political agenda. He wanted to win the goddamn war,
right?
Which is a big difference.
So. And that's the last part I'll say here about the politics of this and generals and everything else is like, if you're trying to win a war, politics generally isn't involved. Like, you don't care who it is or when it is. Like, even with the Bin Laden thing when he was shot, you know, and killed, like, you know, people were like, oh, well, President Obama's going to take, you know, the credit for this and everything else. It's like, hey, man, whoever was in there at the time is always going to get the credit for it. Does that mean you wait so you can get your guy in there, your thing in there? No. If you're fighting a war and you want to end it, end it.
Yeah.
No matter who's in there. If you're trying to get the fucking biggest terrorist in the world, great. If you know where he is, end it. Who gives a fuck who's in there? And that's the way it should be. But, you know, alas, here we are. So it was a fascinating interview, and we greatly appreciated his time today. If you'd like to check out the book, it is Risk, A User's Guide. It is out now, and it is number one in multiple categories on Amazon as we speak. For D'Anthony Holloway, I'm Ross Patterson. This is the Drinking Bros Podcast. Good night, everyone.